Major John Lucky Luckadoo's last combat mission, 25 in all, as a B-17 pilot was on February 13, 1944. He was only 22, yet older beyond his years. Today, Lucky is 100 years old. In his spare time, he speaks with middle and high school students about his experience in the war. He said he wants everyone, especially young people, to remember a life lesson he's valued over the last century. That is, to live each day to its fullest, because it may be your last. Luckadoo goes by Lucky, a nickname he earned while piloting his plane through the Luftwaffe machine gun fire and anti-aircraft flak in sub-zero temperatures on bombing runs over Nazi-occupied France and Germany. He is the last living original B-17 pilot of the 8th Air Force's 100th Bomb Group, known as the Bloody 100th. Lucky said he retired multiple B-17s that only held together long enough to get him back to the ground, once with his frostbitten feet frozen to the airplane pedals after another high-altitude mission. He said, "The bottom line is it doesn't matter how skilled you are or how well you perform your function, but that you're just extremely, incredibly lucky to survive."
Thank you, folks. If y'all been here during the week, you'll know that this is my 9th and final production of Warbirds in Review, and I thank y'all for being here. I hope you have safe travels home, but the reason we're here today, it was kind of interesting. Connie and I talked about this a while back, and we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of the United States Air Force. But then she says, oh, and by the way, we've got this guest who's going to be here, whose name is Lucky Luckadoo, and yeah, he was a member of the 100th Bomb Group, B-17, and I'm kind of going, Connie, I said, well, we can't do all of this. You know, we can do a part of it, but we can't do all of it. And she said, okay, you know, you're the moderator, you decide. And so I have decided. So I'm going to briefly touch on the United States Air Force and its inception back in 1947. But the whole key is this man that's sitting right there right now. And we're going to open that up to some questions from Sam Bass. If you probably recognize him also. He's been up here as a moderator for years. But the reason I put him up here this time is because Lucky and I were talking yesterday, and Sam got involved. And I said, Sam, I said, you know, you've got a lot of time in a B-17, and he flew the B-17 for 20 years. He was flying the EAA B-17, so he's kind of a B-17 expert of sorts, not like Lucky at altitude, et cetera. But I said, nah, I said, Sam, we need to do a tag team here, so that's what we're going to do. We're on a tight time schedule today, so at 11 o'clock, we're going to end up having to thank Lucky, and he's going to head back to the book signing back there. And then I have to pass on that there's another individual who we were notified that this guy was going to show up and had expressed an interest in coming to see Warbirds, and his name is C.Q. Brown. And if you all don't recognize the name, put a general in front of that, and you'll go, oh, yeah, General Brown, the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. He's going to be here today, not for this presentation, but he expressed an interest when he found out that Lucky was going to be here. And Lucky says, yeah, okay, I think I can fit him into my schedule. So So Lucky's going to fit the chief of staff of the Air Force into his schedule here lately. We had a little different plan in terms of aircraft, but originally it was going to be PT-17 Stearman. You know, that's kind of how the Air Force began way back when. And we were going to have an A-10. Well, we really wanted the F-35, but he's parked over there somewhere to indicate, hey, kind of, you know, the beginning and where we're at right now with the fifth generation fighters. As you can see, things have changed here a little bit. We got an F-5 over to my right. We got a T-33 over here. And that still gives you an indication of, hey, where our Air Force has been, if you will. Yeah, the Stearman would have been nice, and you probably got some Stearman time, didn't you, Lucky?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so that's how that started. And oh, by the way, and we'll talk about it later, he was one of the first members of the, quote, real Air Force back then, 1947. He was a member. He was in. He started out in the Army Air Corps, and then, hey, next thing you know, he's into the United States Air Force. And as long as we're talking about aircraft, we're still working on a thank you for the F-5, but I heard that they're in the audience, and Kathy Tyler and Steve Jones, are you in the audience? There we go, right there. They are the owners of this beautiful T-33 up here. So thank you very much for allowing us to borrow it for an hour here or so. We really do appreciate that very much. And with that, I'll say, yeah, 1947, that's when, hey, they finally decided that, hey, the Army can't handle it, the Navy can't handle it, we need to start a special branch of service, and they did. And that's when the United States Air Force started. Yeah, it's gone on from there with a variety of airplanes. Like I said, we're up to the fifth generation fighter now. The the bombers are they're still working on the latest and greatest after the B-2. And I'll say from an experience standpoint, I'm a B-1 pilot for a little while, and it was fun. It was great. But hey, they're at the next iteration from there. And on the fighter side of things, that fifth generation F-22 and F-35 is really nice. But I talked to Ben, our ground handler here. I said, you know what we really need out here is another airplane that would fit very easily out here. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, the prediction right now is 40% of the United States Air Force is going to be flown with these types of airplanes in the future. And he says, what are you talking about? And if y'all don't know, hey, I'm talking about drones, okay? And drones are out there, and they're going to be more and more of our fighting force. Why? Because it doesn't take our pink bodies here and put them into close combat and battle. But we're working on getting either a Predator or a Reaper out here next year so you can kind of see, hey, this is where we're going. Mission of the Air Force, fly and fight. Don't you ever forget it. That was something that I learned way back when. I'm a product of the Air Force, if you will. I went to the Air Force Academy. I did graduate. I wasn't at the top of my class, but I was. I graduated. And it was a good thing. Turned into a fighter pilot. They taught me how to fly. And as I said, I was an F-4 guy, an F-16 guy, a B-1 guy, airline guy a little bit, Air National Guard. And thank you very much for having that. I think it's a Texas Air National Guard sticker on the back of that. Yeah, I'm a guard guy from way back also. So thank you for having that there. Again, mission, fly and fight. As far as I was concerned, no, the mission of the Air Force was to beat Army and beat Navy in the football games. And I still think that way, but no, one team, one fight, as they say, and indeed, we are one team out there. Like I say, the Air Force, I could go on and on to talk about it. Something I did learn, and if you don't know the motto of the Air Force, integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. Those are three things that were put into our minds way back when, and I gotta say, it's something I never forgot. In addition to an honor code that we learned at the Air Force Academy, don't lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate anybody amongst us, and that has served me well over my almost 70 years right now. This is some of the airplanes. This is some of the history. But what I'm going to do now is get into Lucky and what this man did. He does have a book just recently published. When I found out that he was going to be here, I got it. I read it. I think I read it in about 3 or 4 hours. That's how it it gained my attention and kept my attention. The name of it is Damn Lucky. And this is a man who got 25 missions in the B-17 in the bloody 100th. He went to war, as I remember, what was it, with a Bible in your flight jacket?
Flight suit.
In his flight suit and a white scarf, okay? And I think he'll be the first to recognize that, yeah, he's a lucky man to be here. He's here for a reason, though. The big guy upstairs said, no, Lucky, hey, I'm going to keep you around a while so that you can do stuff like this. And we thank him and we thank you for being here and allowing us to talk to you a little bit about that.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to sit down now and just talk a little bit about, first, how you got into it. You were in college, as I remember, and you and a close friend named Sully decided that you wanted to get into it. And how did that all work out?
Well, actually, when we graduated from high school together as best friends, and Sully and I both wanted to learn to fly, we knew that the storm clouds over Germany and Europe were going to ultimately affect us in the States, that we would be prime candidates to serve if it and when it did. And the smartest thing, the coolest thing that we thought we could do was to go to Canada and learn to fly, get our commissions, and then when ultimately America was involved in the Second World War, that we would then be able to transfer to the Army Air Corps, as it was then, in grade, already be trained, and would be a step or two ahead of our buddies. That seemed to be a very logical and astute way of coping with circumstances at the time. We had entered college together, fraternity brothers together, and so we applied to Canada, and they welcomed us with both arms and said, sure, you guys come on up. We'd be happy to train you. But since you're underage, we will require parental consent. Well, it so happened that Sully was an only child. His dad had been involved in the First World War, had been horribly mustard gassed, and died a terrible death before Sully even knew him. So he was all his mother had. And when we presented the plan to her, she said, you know, Sully, if you really and honestly feel that this is what you must do, then you have my blessing. Consequently, I thought, likewise, my parents would view the situation pretty much in the same fashion. So when I presented it to my family and asked for their permission, my mother said, well, as long as Ms. Sullivan has seen fit to allow her only offspring to do this, I hate to see you do it, but I guess I would agree too. But your father will have to agree. And when he came home and he heard about it, he said, you blithering idiots don't have a cotton-picking idea of what you're doing or what you're getting into. Over my dead body would I ever give you my consent. So you get back in school. So consequently, I was unable to join Sully, but he did go to the Montreal and did get trained on Spitfires and went through the North African campaign successfully. And eventually, when Pearl Harbor occurred, there was no question about my service. And I didn't require parental consent. So I joined up, Air Corps as an aviation cadet, and was admitted and went to flight school.
Okay, there's more to that story, though, because you and Sully met up again several years later, from what you said in your book, and I thought that was a very interesting meeting. How
Indeed.
Did that work out?
Indeed. Actually, he came up to, he was based back in England by the time I got there, and he came up one day to visit me at a Spitfire, and I took him up in a B-17 and showed him what it was like, put him in the cockpit, let him get the feel of the aircraft. And I don't know whether all of you are aware or not, but most people that go into the Air Force as pilots all want to be fighter pilots. They have all the fun. But he looked at me and he said, "Buster, this ain't flying. You ain't nothing but a truck driver." And I said, "Well, Sully, we need truck drivers too in this war." And he said, "Well, you go ahead and land, and you fly my Spit, and you'll find out what flying is all about." And I said, "Nada, nada, nada. I'd kill myself." But he insisted. And foolishly, I got in his Spitfire, and he says, "It's just a piece of cake," which was a common expression for the Brits and the Canadians. He showed me the controls and everything, and he says, "Take her up." So foolishly, I did. And of course, as you can tell, I'm here to tell the tale, but it was scary as all hell. And I barely got it around the pattern and gingerly put it back down on the ground without killing myself. And he said, "Now that's really flying." And I said, "Well, you got that right." So he invited me to come down and visit him at his base. And I was unable to do that because of I was later assigned the duties of operations officer of my squadron in addition to continuing to fly my missions. And so I was busier than a one-armed paper hanger and couldn't get off for a month or two until I finally did wangle a test flight on a B-17, and I went down to his base, which was only about 30 miles away from mine, and squeezed that B-17 into a fighter field whose runways are only about half the length of the bomber bases. And as I was standing on the brakes to keep from running off the end of the runway, I looked off to the side, and here was a wreckage still smoldering. And I didn't think too much about it, but I went on to the control tower, and the officer of the day came out and said, "Yank, what the heck are you doing here? You lost? You need petrol?" I said, no, "I'm just on a social call to visit a friend of mine, Flight Lieutenant Sullivan. Would you kindly show me his quarters?" And he said, "Well, you have to see the CO. And I said, "Well, I know that's protocol. When you land at a foreign base, you certainly report to the commanding officer and tell him why you're there. But I said, I am in a bit of a hurry and I have to get back, and could you just please show me his quarters?" And he said, "No, you have to see the CO. And so I was ushered in to the wing commander's office. I need to tell you that Sully had been transitioned from the Spitfire to the Hawker Hurricane. I'm sorry, the Hawker Typhoon, which was a vicious airplane. It was so overpowered that as you took off, the torque was so strong that it pulled the aircraft to the side and you had to take off with full opposite rudder. Unfortunately, the afternoon before, Sully was on takeoff with his wingman on a rhubarb, which was a strafing mission in that typhoon. He got about 50 feet in the air and his engine quit, and he just cartwheeled in. And that was his wreckage that I had viewed when I landed. And he informed me that he was in the process of notifying his mother, his next of kin, and he wanted me to do it. And I said, well, sir, with all due respect, he was not flying for the Air Force. He was flying for you. He was under your command. It's your responsibility. He said, I know that, but since you were his best friend, I certainly think she would appreciate getting that sad news from you rather than me. So I sat down and cabled her and had to inform her that Sully had died. I tell you that story because the loss of a friend in combat, it is quite different than it is in civilian life. There is usually no funeral. There's no memorial. There's no reference whatsoever to the fact that they were gone. But when they're shot down, all you have are 10 empty bunks in the barracks. However, in this case where I lost my best friend, there was a funeral, which I had to attend and did. And Sully is buried and still in Brookwood Cemetery in that. But that loss was more profound to me than any of the others that the comrades that I ever flew with in World War II.
That's tough. Even my condolences now. I'm sorry that you lost your best friend. I'll open up to Sam now. Another B-17 pilot. He's ready.
Well, speaking of the losses, and tell us why they called it the Buddy 100.
Sam, there were several reasons. Basically, we got the moniker of the Bloody 100 because of our extreme losses. We went over in the spring of 1943. Flew our aircraft, brand new B-17Fs, across the North Atlantic before we had any fighter escort. And the only escort we got was from the RAF, who could carry us just to the enemy coast, and then they were out of fuel and had to return. So our heaviest losses, we did not end up in the 8th Air Force as the bomber group with the heaviest losses overall, but we were darn close to it. I think we were second or third. But initially, when we lost big. And the Germans, we did not have any idea that we were going to be confronted with the professional Luftwaffe quality of pilots that we encountered. And when we arrived in England, Axis Sally came on the radio and said, welcome to the war, 100th. You've made the biggest mistake in your lives, coming here and entering a war that's none of your business. But now that you're here, we are going to teach you a lesson. And by God, they did. Believe me. Because They were professionals. They'd been fighting for 4 years when we got there. They were battle-tested. They had excellent equipment, better than ours. And they were fighting for their homeland. And we were miles away from ours. So it was, they had a different incentive altogether.
Right. Well, now you had, you speaking of the experience of the Luftwaffe, what was your experience when you trained in the United States, you transitioned into the B-17, how much time did you have when you flew your first mission?
Well, Sam, that's a strange story because another unusual thing that happened in the 100th, which did not happen in any other group in the 8th Air Force, was after the group had already gone through their pre-combat training for months, they took 40 of us from my flying school class in Valdosta, Georgia, 43B, sent us to Kearney, Nebraska to join the 100th Bomb Group to replace all of their co-pilots. They literally pulled all of the co-pilots out of the right seats, signed them new crews and to other groups as replacements, and put us brand new qualified pilots, multi-engine pilots, but never having been in a B-17 or a four-engine airplane before, into the right seat as co-pilots. And as you may or may not know, the co-pilot is the second in command of the crew, 10-man crew. So if the pilot is incapacitated for any reason, the co-pilot becomes the airplane crew commander. Mm-hmm. And they put us in that position. So they pulled us together and assigned us new aircraft, had been modified with Tokyo tanks, and sent us to combat.
And how much time did you have? You said, 220 hours?
At that time, when I landed in Newfoundland on our way over, I had a total of about 20 hours in the B-17 going to combat.
How about your class of 40? How many made it back out of your class of 40?
Ultimately, 4 out of the 40.
Wow.
Completed a tour. Mm-hmm. Your choices were either to be shot down, captured, killed, or luckily get home.
What was the worst mission that you flew in terms of aircraft losses? I remember one particular one that a normal number went out and very few returned.
Exactly. In October of 1943, the original crew that I had gone overseas with had completed 25 missions, but I did not. They had a standard operating procedure, SOP, that if your crew led the group formation, that the co-pilot was replaced by a command pilot, and the co-pilot went back and flew the tail gun position. So they put me in the tail. Never fired a 50 caliber in my life. And that was a stupid, that was military intelligence for you. That was a stupid idea. I'd like to get my hands on the guy that dreamed that one up. But anyway, they were supposed to be the fire control officer as a pilot in the tail of the lead airplane. Well, what was completely ignored was that the tail gunner had no communication with anybody else in the entire formation. He could only communicate with the pilot on intercom, and then the pilot had to switch channels and notify the rest of the formation about whatever danger he was reporting. And by then, it was all over, so it was useless. But anyway, when I got back after that first mission, I said, Luckadoo ain't getting in the tail again, ever. Take my wings or court-martial me or do whatever you have to, but I'm not getting in the tail. I don't know what I'm doing. I've never had any gunnery experience. And they said, well, okay, you'll have to sit on the ground. So that's why I didn't finish up with the original crew. They did the fastest tour in the 8th Air Force. And they completed their 25 missions, luckily, in 91 days.
Mm-hmm. But back to that one mission, as I remember, did 12 airplanes launch and only two or four come back? I can't remember exactly.
I got sidetracked, Ed. Thank you. My worst mission turned out to be the first one I flew after the crew that I had flown 21 missions with went home. And I was then an instructor pilot with a brand new crew. And we were, it was the beginning of what became known as Black Week in the 8th Air Force. On October the 8th of 1943, our target was Bremen, almost as deeply into Germany as Berlin. And on that occasion, we sent out 18 airplanes. And the Luftwaffe was so aggressive and were pressing their attack so viciously that for the first time we had ever experienced it, they were literally flying through their own flak. Normally, when we turned on the initial point or the bomb run to drop our bombs, the fighters would leave us alone and take and allow the anti-aircraft to hopefully damage us enough to force us out of the formation. And then they would pick us up as we came off the target and attack the stragglers but normally they didn't fly through their own flak, but over Bremen they did. And as a result, we were experiencing mid-air collisions. They were actually impacting our aircraft, ramming us. My right wingman was rammed and blew up. The plane in front of me was rammed and it blew up. And on the bomb run, out of the 18 aircraft that had started out in the 100th Bomb Group, 12 were shot down, shot out of the formation. Several of them did make it back, but I brought the remains of what was in the formation home by attaching to a second wave of bombers behind us with 6 ships. The next day, our mission was to Marienburg, and the 100 sent out 18 airplanes and got back 9. The third day, we went to Munster. And as the book reveals, a fellow named Rosenthal, who was a replacement pilot in our group, ended up flying over two tours. But we could only put up 13 aircraft over Munster. Rosie was the only airplane to return.
Now, part of that week was the raid to Swineford. Is that correct? On Thursday, the raid to Swineford on October the 14th.
The 14th. Yes, that was the end of the Black Week.
And that was the whole group lost 60 airplanes. Is that correct?
Well, the entire formation, that right. was the wing, lost 60 airplanes on that mission.
Now out of 369. They changed their tactics after that, that you You were not to go any further than where you could have escort. Is that correct?
No. No. We didn't change our tactics until Doolittle assumed command of the 8th Air Force, and that was in January, the following January 1st, when he cut the fighters loose from escorting and said, you go down and catch the Germans on takeoff before they can get off the ground and stop all this dogfighting, and it'll be more effective than it proved to be.
Just a quick side note, a typical mission. How high were you? How cold was it? Physiologically, I'm sure a lot of people probably don't put themselves in that position, but a typical mission, how high were you guys flying?
Well, that's a very important question, because it had more effect on our ability to bomb, to perform, than any other factor. And that was because the B-17 was totally unpressurized. In order to survive at altitude, we had to be on supplemental oxygen. And we normally bombed between 25 and 29,000 feet. The temperatures at that altitude.
We got a flyby for you, by the way.
There's Lucky. A B-17.
There's a B-17 right there. Perfect timing.
We programmed that. Thank you.
All right, so there
but
you are at altitude.
The bitter cold that we endured at high altitude because we were unpressurized was unbelievable. It was 50 to 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And this so affected our ability to perform that we were practically frozen stiff. And yet, strangely enough, in the heat of battle, when the fighters are coming in, the flak is coming up, and you're struggling and your best to maintain your position in the formation, you suddenly, as a pilot, discovered you're perspiring profusely, and that perspiration freezes instantly. And what that does is create ice crystals in your flow of oxygen. The moisture does. And so you're ending up trying to crack up ice crystals with one hand and fly the damned airplane with the other. So the cold, and for hours on end, and mind you, in the waist gun position on a B-17, where these poor gunners are standing there in an open window on the side of the aircraft with a single 50-caliber machine gun. In that wind and that cold, we had tremendous injuries from frostbite. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my only physical injury in my entire tour was when I had a hole knocked in the nose, plexiglass nose, and this jet of cold air was hitting my feet. And they froze my feet to the rudders. And luckily, I did not lose my toes, but that was just another case where I was damn lucky.
To backtrack just a little bit here, and you do your initial training over here in the States on the B-17. You're a crew. You're all together in this crew. You come over and you're enthusiastic about flying your first mission. But you fly that first mission, and then you come back, and now here are all these empty bunks. How do you get your program yourself to where you can do 24 more?
Sam, you know, I've been asked that question before several times. And when I try to rationalize on it or think of what our mindsets were and how we psyched ourselves, up to get back in that airplane the next day, I honestly don't know. I only know that in order to do it, you had to stay focused on your mission and had to believe that you'd survive. But at 21 years old, you're a hair-headed college kid. You don't know from nothing, but you think you're the smartest guy in the world. When I look back on it now, from 100 years, it occurs to me that my going to war and putting myself on the line day after day under those circumstances was not the smartest thing I ever did.
Well, you mentioned yesterday that war changes. You don't come out of the war the same. Would you elaborate on that a little bit?
Whether you're in the Air Force and flying or whether you're in the trenches in the Army, nobody goes to war and gets shot at and comes back the same person. And as we were writing this book, when I was collaborating with this writer, I said, you know, I'm fully aware that there are two things that you can't possibly, as well as you can describe and put in narrative form what I experienced, you can't convey the real terror and horror of getting shot at. Nor can you really convey adequately the bitter cold that and its impact on us. But he did a very excellent job, I think, if you care to read the story, of describing pretty much what it was like to be in the Bloody Hundreds.